I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sports ad free. That's amazon.com/sports ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah.
You do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking hour?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Chris, first of all, thanks for coming in and talking to us this afternoon. You are the author of many, many books about sports, leadership and management. And it's in that latter category I want to chat to you about in most depth, I think. Your most recent book is Quiet Leadership, co-written with Carlo Ancelotti. And I suppose there's a sort of treatise on his methods and his secret to success, if you like. How did that come to fruition? How did you end up being the man who wrote that with him?
We actually met through his wife, funnily enough. Many years ago, I was the deputy dean in charge of MBA programs at Cass Business School, funnily enough, around the corner from this studio.
Yeah.
And his wife was one of my students. And years and years later, we bumped into each other. And I said to her, what are you doing in this country? It's nice to see you. So I'm over here with my husband. Oh, who's he? Carlo Ancelotti, really?
Right. Okay.
Right, introduce me.
Yeah.
And we became friends, and at some stage later, he decided he wanted to write a book that wasn't just an autobiography, that was much more about his leadership style and much more about the relationship to other leadership organisations, to businesses and so on and so forth, to see whether there were any transferable skills to a certain extent. So I added that bit to the process, let's look at the transferable skills. So what we did with the book was interesting. We actually looked at the book and said, what are the problems that managers come up against and leaders come up against in every walk of life? Okay, Carlo, how did you deal with that in your walk of life? And then saw if those skills appeared to be transferable or not.
And I mean, I suppose we may as well start with Carlo then. Do you think he is particularly unique in terms of management? I mean, clearly he's a pretty sort of calm, considered guy. And in the book, which I read and enjoyed, I think he's pretty quick to tell you that being calm and being quiet and being reserved isn't a sign of weakness. It's a form of management and leadership in its own right. And that's something that he presumably very much subscribes to. Or do you think that's just his natural personality?
I think it's a bit of both. I think he definitely is his natural personality when you get to spend time with him. Obviously, when you're writing a book together, you spend a lot of time together and you get to know each other pretty well. Mm. And it is who he is. But interestingly, also looking at any individual, you look at how other people think about them. And luckily for the book, I was able to interview loads of players who've all played for him. And nobody's got a bad word for him. So he obviously creates these relationships. And that's the basis of his management style, to be able to say, I have a relationship with all these people. I empower them in modern parlance. Mm. I do all these sort of things. But basically, we like each other, and I trust them to have the skills and capabilities to do their jobs, and I'm not going to interfere too much if everything's going well, and I'm going to tweak things slightly, but nothing major. He is a bit also like, and I know this is stereotypical, but he is a bit like most Italian managers. He's very detailed on structure and defensive formations and so on, but less so than one of his great mentors, Arrigo Sacchi, who Carlo tells the story that Sacchi used to literally move people by about 3 inches. So I need you to stand here. Yeah. This is where I want you. Yeah. And Carlo said when he first started coaching them, they all thought, this is crazy. Mm. And sounds a bit like what went on at Chelsea at the beginning with Conte there. In the first 6 to 8 weeks that Conte was there, the players weren't that happy. They were sort of getting this information. They were having to do drills with no opposition and all this sort of stuff, which is very Italian, tactical Italian. Mm. Of course, when the results start coming through, they all get, oh, hang on, this guy might know what he's talking about. So Carlo's a bit somewhere in between that very rigid Italian, everybody's going to be in this position, and a totally laissez-faire approach. He is very, very detailed as well, but more in the minutiae of how individuals play than in tactical formations.
So Carlo is clearly a certain type of manager than a calm, considered chap. We see lots of different types of manager at the top level in football, and I guess that fascinates me because they appear to have a lot of different modes of managing, a lot of which seem to work. Do you think that someone who's vastly different to Jose, to Carlo Ancelotti, i.e. Jose Mourinho or Jurgen Klopp, do you think they start from the same spot, the same basis, or do they come from a completely different philosophy, completely different point of view?
I don't think they come from a different philosophy. I think they grow into the managers that they are. What they come from is a certain type of personality. They are a certain type of person. And ultimately, you know, one of the key things about management is to remain authentic, because the players or the workforce, they'll soon find you out.
Yeah.
If you try and be a Klopp or a Conte when you're really an Ancelotti or a Bob Paisley or whatever, it's not going to work. And the players get that straight away. One of the interesting things, I did an interview many years ago with Gordon Strachan when he was Premier League manager. And I said, how long does it last, the fact that you're a great international player in the dressing room as a manager? And he said, till the first team talk.
Right, okay.
He said, because the players are so selfish in the right sort of obsessive, ambitious way, that they will very quickly work out whether you are of any use to them.
Yeah, okay. Interesting. Right, okay.
And if you're not, they don't care who you played for.
Yeah.
And if you are, they don't care who you played for, or if you never played. So when Mourinho arrives at Chelsea...
Well, I was going to say, let's explore that in the case of Mourinho, who never really played to a good level.
So Mourinho arrives at Chelsea... Where's he come from? He's come as a European champion.
Yeah.
And he walks into the dressing room and said, I'm a European champion.
Yeah.
If you want to be European champions, follow me.
Yeah.
And they're like, okay, we'll have some of that. Then he has to prove it.
Yeah.
But he obviously did, because they still, people like John Terry retiring, today, still talks about, interestingly, both Carlo and Mourinho as the best managers.
But he was able to relate to and work with both of them.
Correct.
As successfully. I mean, that probably gives credit to John Terry.
Absolutely.
But on the Mourinho thing, you mentioned as he came into Chelsea as a European champion, and I obviously get that. I get how that works for the players. But when Mourinho comes in without having done anything, without even being able to, by their standards, even being able to kick a ball properly, how does he get them on board early on then? How does he say, look, follow me? How does he convince them to follow? He must have such a force of charisma and personality that they just want to be a part of it.
The stories I've been told are exactly that. You know, I've done this. If you want to do this, none of you have won anything. And at that time, none of them had. Mm. None of you have won anything. If you want to win something, this is the way to do it. And I'll show you how to do it. And then his method, I think, is to get results very quickly, which is interesting the way he's gone about things at Old Trafford. Mm. I think when you look at him, Old Trafford, I think he is struggling with the fact that he wants to stay there for a long time. Mm. But it's not normally. So he normally, if you look at the seasons when they've won anything, they've won it by Christmas. Mm. They just come flying out of the blocks and then the players will go, well, we're winning. Hmm. You know, as I said, there was some concern among the players at Chelsea in the first couple of months that Conte was there about, you know, they weren't winning, they got beat by Arsenal badly. You know, does this guy know what he's talking about? And then gradually changes it and they get into a winning. You know, win. People say, what comes first, you know? Hmm. Win, you know, winning or team spirit. Hmm. Trust me, it's women. It's winning.
Yeah.
It's probably women as well.
Yeah.
Freudian slip.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's fascinating to me, because one of the things that's probably quite regularly overlooked in the football industry and in the football world is that people don't seem to understand, I suppose, in light of what we're talking about here with the art of management, that certain players aren't going to be conducive to working successfully with certain managers. So you'll get an average fan who'll say, why hasn't our club signed this player? And it might well be that the manager and the management structure has thought, well, he's a great player, but he's not going to last 5 minutes here with me or with this team or with this manager we've got. And not much is made of that, but that's presumably very important.
Yeah, and also it's very important, the working relationship between the senior people at the top level as well, mm. which is why a lot of managers like to bring staff with them. Mm. You know, now, I'm not a big proponent of that. I mean, going back to Carlo, I mean, I know we've talked a lot about him, but going back to Carlo, because I know most about how that worked, when he came to Chelsea, he was used to bringing a lot of staff with him, but Chelsea said, no, we've got a lot of good staff in place. And when I spoke to Carlo about, you know, when we were doing the book, I said, why does everybody think that somewhere else they go, they're not going to find people they can trust? Because the argument is, well, I know I can trust so-and-so. Well, why would you think that when you go somewhere else, you won't find people? Sure. And of course, he finds Paul Clement there, who he really trusts, and takes him everywhere else. Yeah. So he just moves on. So, I mean, that working relationship at the top is as important as the working relationship with the players. Because if you get the right complementary staff around you, even though I, as the number one, really don't get on with my captain or centre half.
Yeah.
My number two is his best mate, and we can make sure we keep him on board.
Yeah,
in that way.
So to that level, I think I'm right in saying that David Moyes didn't keep anyone at Old Trafford when he took over the job. So he probably should have done then to get an understanding of the culture and what it means to have a bit of continuity, what it means to be a manager at Man United, what the club's like.
I haven't spoken to David Moyes since then. But I would imagine he would regret the number of people he took from Everton with him, simply because if he would have been really selfish, ultimately selfish, if I'd have been his advisor, I'd said, right, don't take anybody. Hmm. Manchester United just won this by 11 points. Hmm. Keep that staff in place, so you're a good guy. If you don't win anything this year, you can blame them. Hmm. If you do win everything, you're a genius for keeping them there. But at least you've given yourself a year to settle in.
Bed in, yeah.
And his response when we were talking at the time about difficulties, we had a brief chat when he'd just taken over the job. I was somewhere else, just happened to be having a cup of coffee. And I said, you know, it's a bit dangerous, this. And he said, yeah, but I've got a 5-year contract. I can really get things sorted out. So he genuinely believed that a 5-year contract meant he had that amount of time, which I was surprised about, you know, given the industry.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, those two things together made him make decisions that he might think twice about now. But I think you're right. You know, he did virtually replace all of the staff at United at that particular time, which was difficult. You know, they'd been there a long time and they just won the championship.
But
everybody says it was a bad year and all that.
Got to win it.
You won it by 11 points.
Yeah, you still got to win it. On the longevity thing, just to follow up on that then, the sort of conventional wisdom in the media and amongst all the people who like football, I suppose, is that continuity is important. Stick with your managers. Don't be so trigger happy. You know, don't fire managers quickly and unnecessarily. But there's nothing really concrete to suggest that that works, is there? I mean, that's not built on any sort of science or any sort of experience, is it?
No, I think if you look at it, it's the other way around. People stay a long time because they're winning. They don't win because they're staying a long time.
Yeah, so you, yeah. I mean, yeah, because there used to be an old adage which was that if you had to fire someone after 5 years, they were the wrong person for the job. If you had to fire them after 5 minutes, you were the wrong you did the wrong thing by hiring them. Exactly. But that doesn't seem to exist in football, though.
Well, I think it should. Mm. I think it's a good maxim. Interestingly, a lot of the research tells us that if you get a new manager in. And I know this, everybody hates the numbers and the statistics, and I get that. But there are certain things you can detect from statistics. And one of the things is if you get a new manager in, and after 8 games, he's averaging less than 0.75 points a game, you're probably good to get rid of him quick.
Right, okay.
Now,
there's no point waiting around to turn it around.
But does that count? This is the thing that people don't get about statistics. Somebody will always come up then and go, well, Fergie only got 0.6 in his first 8 games, and look what happened to him. You go, yeah, of course there's an anomaly. There's the odd one who's different. But basically, if people are not quite getting it right in that first 8 games, they're probably not going to get it right statistically. As I say, I'm sure anybody listening to this will be on the phone immediately.
Have their own example.
By the way, don't give out my phone number. they will be on the phone immediately saying, well, what about X and what about Y? Yeah, that's true. But yeah, 90% of the cases, it's not a bad judge. So going back to your maxim about, well, if we've got to fire him that quickly, we made a mistake in employing him. It goes back to the, you know, hire slow, fire quick. Mm. But the problem in football is they always hire quick. You know, so, you know, Zola walks out yesterday, there's a new guy in place the next day. Mm. You know,
what's the reason for that, do you think?
Well, I'm not quite sure. Well, you know, first of all, there's no succession planning. Mm. You know, so because managers bring with them people who are sort of, to a certain extent, professional number twos, you know, then you know, are you going to promote that guy into a senior position? But so there's no succession planning but that's true in business as well, you know. Mm. All of a sudden somebody walks away and everybody's, oh my God, what do we do now? Well, actually, you knew he was going to walk away. Statistically, managers in football are not going to be there maximum 2 years. Mm. You know, well, then you know, get ready as soon as you've hired him to start looking for a replacement, because he's not going to be there that long, either by your choice or by their choice.
Yeah. I suppose managers can be, at the very top level at least, they can be, I suppose, for want of a better word, quite egotistical. And for example, with David Moyes, to go back to the Manchester United example, clearly it would have been beneficial to everyone for Moyes to go in maybe for the last year of Ferguson's tenure and sit under him for a year. But David Moyes is an established manager in his own right, and he's managed at a big club, Everton. He was there for 10 years beforehand. He's not realistically going to do that, is he? So it's not easy for them to do that. I know there are examples of it happening. Like
you could have done the succession planning by not having him sat next to Ferguson, but by saying to him that we think you're the guy, and all the conversations about number of people that are going to be coming across could have happened in that year.
Yeah.
And you could have then said, as the CEO, if I'd have been the CEO at Manchester United, I'd have said, it's not happening. Either you come and use this team, or don't come.
Because he'd have wanted the job anyway.
Is he going to not come?
No, yeah, of course.
Which was a bit like Carlo at Chelsea. He wanted the Chelsea job. He wanted to try for the Premier League. He thought that was a really good opportunity. Mm. So he was prepared to compromise to a certain extent, and found actually it was a really good model. I mean, he says in the book, you know, it's a really good model to be able to come into an established, settled background. So we talk about Chelsea being sort of chaotic, but actually, if everybody underneath that one guy stays the same, actually it's maybe not as chaotic as we think it is. Mm.
And I suppose that brings me on quite nicely to the continuity point and the sort of making preparation for what's going to happen after the manager moves on. It brings me on quite nicely to a question I wanted to put to you about players becoming managers. And I think I'm right in saying in one of your books you talk about how there's nothing to suggest that just because you are a player, you're going to become a good manager automatically. Now, clearly that's the case. I mean, there are good players who've become terrible managers. There are good players who've become good managers.
There are players who've never played.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, Wenger, Marino never played at any sort of level, but but they become great managers. So, as you say, there's virtually no, well, there's no cause and effect.
No,
there might be some correlation, but it's very, very little.
But do you think players fully appreciate and understand how different the skill set is to be a manager?
No,
no. And do you think they're interested? Presumably, the best ones are willing to learn and accept that it's a new discipline entirely.
Yeah. Well, I teach a module on the UEFA Pro license course, so we get all the managers who want to move up or aspire into that. And what I've noticed I've been doing that for about 8 years now, and the difference between 8 years ago when they were like, well, what do we need to know all this stuff about, to now, when they're very conscientious, they do lots of good work. Some of the projects that they do for the course are really good quality. I work in universities and I see the quality of what students turn out, and a lot of these guys are turning out equivalent sort of stuff like that. And there are courses starting to run which are more about management in terms of sports directors and performance directors and all this sort of stuff. I mean, sports are a big business now, so the training and development of people is going to get better and better. And the difference that I've noticed in that 7 or 8 years is they're much more conscientious about and much more willing to learn about the whole business as opposed to just what goes on the pitch.
Because that gives them a better understanding of what pressures they're going to be under
correct.
And why, basically.
Absolutely correct.
I think a lot of fans possibly myself included actually, will understand that the pro licence exists and people are required to do it to manage at the top level. I don't know if a huge amount of people will know exactly what it entails and why it's so important for them, for potential managers to do it. I mean, what's the reason that it's in place, would you say? Just because it gives everyone a basis, everyone's a platform to work from.
Yeah, it gives them. I think what it gives them is a great opportunity to survive. And if you talk to people like Richard Bevan at the LMA, he says the most important thing is surviving for the first year. If you survive for the first year, you're doing well. And so this is giving them a toolkit to survive for that first year. It's very difficult though, because you get huge differences in the type of ownership. And one of the things that we do on the course is to talk to them about the value and seriousness of managing upwards and trying to manage the expectations of that guy who's actually running your life, who can snap his fingers and you're out of work the next day. I wouldn't say we teach techniques, but we get them to understand what the issues are, and then as individuals they're going to have to deal with those in their own particular ways. But some of them are unaware of the difficulties. I mean, a very simple example is that people looking to go for a job will say to me, well, how much should I ask the wage bill for example?
Yeah.
What's a good wage bill? And I say, well, if it's a first or second division club, there's a wage protocol and you can only have 55 or 60% of the revenue. So what's the revenue of that club? And they go, I don't know. And you say, well, find out.
Yeah.
And then you can only have 55% of that, and then work out whether you can get promoted. And if you think having 55% of that makes you the third lowest wages in that division, don't promise to get them to get them promoted, because it's not going to happen. Yeah. And they're like, right, okay. Now, I think one of the misconceptions about footballers is, and as a ex-footballer myself, is that they're unintelligent. Footballers are not unintelligent. They're often uneducated.
Yeah,
it's not the same thing. But they're smart, and so. One of the things that we do on the calls is just try and open up and say, look, these are the issues you're going to confront. You're pretty smart guys. You know what you're doing. Be ready. And that's really what the course is mostly about, being ready. And obviously that includes all the football side as well, the tactical side, all the analytics and all that sort of stuff. I just do the small business bit of it, which is quite a small part of the course.
Because there'll be some managers and ex-players now of a certain generation who will... who will be reluctant to do that. They'll not want to sit in a classroom. They'll not want to learn. And then they'll bemoan the fact that they don't get job opportunities the next week. So I'm thinking of someone like Tim Sherwood, for example, who clearly doesn't want to go out there and expand his horizons and learn. But clearly, it's very important. I mean, you could easily say, oh, you know, Bill Shankly never did that. Well, fine, but we're not in the 60s and the 70s now. No. You know, we're in a completely different environment, and there are a lot of skills that you need to actually really achieve. And like you say, survive the first couple of years and then move on and build on that. So, yeah, I absolutely agree.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How's your social battery right now? We're nearly at the end of the Premier League season, so I'm pretty drained. So many tense matches, and some not so tense, as well as point deductions, a battle for the title, and teams on the brink of relegation. All that suspense has me needing a well-deserved break. With the air in full swing, it can be easy to get swept up in work, social engagements, even keeping up with all this football, and we can spread ourselves too thin. But with therapy, you can learn to prioritise your time and really recharge your batteries. It's helpful for learning how to set personal boundaries and empowering you to be the best version of yourself, because you should spend your time on your own terms. So, if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/ramble today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/ramble.
With the nature of how managers have to work now, so they have a group of, I mean, we talked earlier before we came on the show, you were saying that ideally as a manager or a CEO or whatever, you want between 8 and 10 direct reports to successfully manage a business or whatever it may be. I was thinking that in the context of football, they're going to have a few coaches, a few physios, they're going to have a big team, and then they're going to have 25 direct players in a squad at the top level. I mean, You also called, if I may steal your line earlier, you called Carlo Ancelotti the diva whisperer for being able to talk to these players and deal with them in a certain way, these hugely talented, egocentric in some cases players. I mean, is it fair to say that the biggest skill you need is to keep that group of 25 players happy at all times?
I don't think not to keep them happy. Mm. I think there's a problem there often, because that often means that you're perceived as not being demanding. In fact, one of the things that Carlo offers is he gets the sack for being perceived as being too friendly with the players and too easygoing with the players. But that's what he got hired for in the first place. Mm. You know, so it's a double-edged sword.
Yeah.
But it's about having the respect of those players. And obviously, it's easier to get that respect if you're a Carlo Ancelotti and you're a Champions League winner as a player and as a coach and as an international player and all of those great things. The players will listen to you. But my experience is that players will give you an opportunity. They'll obviously banter a little bit if you've never played, but they'll give you an opportunity and they'll listen. And if they think you're saying something worth listening to, they'll take it in and they'll try, because most players just want to get better, and they, you know, either as a personal thing or for the rewards or whatever, but they want to improve and they want to get better, so they're going to listen to somebody who they think can add that value. Now, in the first instance, going back to what you were saying about earlier on about players, about there being no correlation between a good player and a good manager, is that the players will say very quickly, this guy doesn't know what he's talking about. You know, and when they talk about losing the dressing room, it doesn't mean they don't like the guy. It doesn't mean they don't respect, they don't think he was a great player. They just don't think he can add any value to them.
Yeah,
and
okay.
As elite sportsmen, they're very selfish. I mean, and I mean that in a in terms of ambition. and obsession. You know, in order to, you know, if you're going to practice anything, you know, you're going to be an international Olympic swimmer, getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning and having your head underwater for 4 hours, you've got to be pretty obsessive.
Yeah.
And so football's just no different. And so if you're that obsessive, you're going to very quickly dismiss somebody you don't think can add any value, no matter who they are, you know, no matter how great a player they were.
Yeah, because I can understand, for example, you've got a squad, a group of individuals, and perhaps some of them are young and still learning their trade, and some of them, in a great example, this would be a sort of sub-keeper, a second-choice keeper. They're usually young or they're beyond their best. They know their role. They've seen it all, done it all. They'll sit on the bench and they'll play when they need to play. But there will be a group of players in that squad who aren't playing. And I think, for me, looking outside in, it seems like the hardest job would be to explain to them they have got a role and to make them feel a part of it, and they can make a contribution, because you don't know when the player playing in your position is going to get injured next week. And Alex Ferguson, in that Class of 92 film, Alex Ferguson apparently had a huge amount of, you know, convoluted and creative ways of telling players they weren't playing. Oh, no, you're my man for November in August, you know, that type of thing. Is there a defined sort of accepted way of being able to do that, or does it just depend on the personality and just do what works for you, really?
I think there isn't a technique, but there's a way of doing it, and the more honest and transparent you are, the better.
Yeah.
What players do value is, and players, we're using the term players now to mean any staff in any way, is equity. You know, everybody being treated equal, and being treated fairly. And if that's true, they'll accept different ranks, they'll accept different wage structures, they'll accept all of that. But if somebody's late and gets fined, and then the next day the star is late and doesn't get fined, that doesn't go down well.
Yeah.
And so that Ferguson was really great at doing that. You know, that time when he sat, when they went away to Leeds, and he sat Beckham in the stand and made him go to the game.
Yeah.
And, you know, because some transgression or another.
Yeah.
And luckily for Ferguson, they won.
Yeah, okay.
You know, everything just sort of dropped into place. But that said to everybody, look, we know he's a star. We know he's getting paid more than everybody else. But actually, as far as this team's concerned, he's one of us. And he does whatever we all do. Now, I don't even know what the transgression was, but clearly, some, you know, he'd upset Fergie in some way or another. But that just treating everybody equally and fairly, and if somebody comes and asks you a straight question, giving a straight answer and saying, yeah, the reason, and we were talking earlier on, you were talking about Jamie Carragher saying that he didn't think he thought that John Terry and Rio Ferdinand were better than him.
Yeah.
And so if the manager said, well, the reason you're not playing, Jamie, is because we think they're better than you, he's going to go, fair enough, isn't he? But if you make a load of stories that, well, we're doing this, he knows you're bullshitting, you know. he's saying, look, I know I'm not better than him, but I'm waiting, you know. So Jamie Carragher would have been like, oh, hang on, he's injured.
Yeah.
Well, that might get game here.
It's true you say that, because he also said to me when I spoke to him, he also said, well, hang on, the reason my England career sort of unravelled is because I was playing centre-back for the team that won the European the Champions League, and I was still being farmed out to full-back for England. So what was going on? It wasn't a fair and transparent process, and I think you're absolutely right. And just to follow up on that stuff, I mean, we talk about...
Well, he could have played three at the back, couldn't he?
Well, he could have done. He probably should have done some of the way. Everyone's doing it now. But just talking about the transferable stuff between everyday management in businesses and whatever the size and in football... The interesting thing about that, though, is, and the difference is that if you've got a workplace full of people and they do roughly similar jobs, you know, there's not going to be a huge difference in pay, relatively speaking. I mean, people don't really talk about pay that much in businesses. And even if they do, they're not going to be vastly different, depending on experience. Of course, you bring that over to football, you've got wildly, probably inaccurate reports on wages a lot of time. Some players getting paid huge amounts, some players not so much. Then that becomes very, very difficult, doesn't it? Because we talk about treating everybody fairly and clearly there's privilege and all that sort of stuff. How difficult is that then when you've got players on wildly different salaries and different bonus structures and stuff?
I think that it is really difficult, but it's a difficulty that's brought on by the business themselves, is that So I'm told, anyway, that when Roy Keane was given a big wage rise that broke the Manchester United wage structure at the time, none of the players complained.
Right, okay.
He's worth it.
Yeah.
And what the problem is if you've got somebody who's not really pulling their weight, so this goes back to this equity thing, if you've got somebody who's not pulling their weight and they get more money, then everybody's going, hang on a minute. I can remember when I was playing at a much lower level, I was a non-league player at Conference. I can remember playing for a whole season, but it was my first season as a young player and I was getting paid a lot less than everybody else. And I went to one of the older players and said, look, I'm going to go in and see the manager because I'm getting paid a lot less than everybody else. He said, look, we've got 10 games to go and we're going to win this league. And during the summer, you're now going to be a championship winner. That's when you're going to ask for more money. I'm like, okay, fine. So there is all that because I was thinking, well, I'm doing at least 1/11th of the work here, and I'm getting paid a lot less money. But that was the deal I signed.
Yeah.
And so I think there's a relationship there where players are perceived not to be pulling their weight or to be in some way disruptive to the organisation. And they're getting big money. It's poison. That's poison.
So, in the context of let's talk about briefly something that's on not most people's lips at the moment in football with Arsenal. Clearly, we've got a situation where Mesut Ozil and Alexis Sanchez are reportedly asking for big money. I mean, huge amounts of money, if the reports are to be believed. Clearly, then you must think that there's a cut off point now where you say no, that's enough. Off you go.
Yeah, I do. I'm not. We're talking about football now, so we're talking about opinions. I don't think that if I were at Arsenal, I don't think I would give in over Ozil. I'm not sure about Sanchez because obviously he's got a lot of goals and he's very well respected by everybody. I don't know whether he's difficult in the dressing room or all these other factors that are going to come into the club's decision, but I do agree with you that there is a cut-off point. And for me, the cut-off point is very simple, is that if I give this guy, let's imagine we're talking about, I don't know, 10 million a year, he's going to go up to 20 million a year. My calculation is, could I get two 10 million players to do more for this club than that one 20 million player? And if the answer is yes, then he's gone.
Okay. And
I know you have to make that decision, and that's for Wenger and his team and people around the club to make that decision. But ultimately, from a business point of view, that should be the CEO.
Okay, but are there players, perhaps even playing today, where no matter what they ask for, you have to give it to them because they're that special?
Yes.
Okay. Lionel Messi. Cristiano Ronaldo, presumably those types.
Maybe
we're talking that level, aren't
we? Yeah. Maybe interesting point though. I think if you'd have asked me 2 years ago, I would have said I would give anything to have Ronaldo.
Yeah,
anything. 31 now.
I think he's 32 actually.
Is he 32
now?
Yeah,
I think so. Yeah.
32 now, but I mean, he's looked after himself. He's in fantastic condition. I mean, when I was with Carlo, we were at Real Madrid and we were in training, and he said that they would get back at 2 o'clock in the morning from away games, and Ronaldo would go into the training centre for his ice baths and everything.
Right.
All the other players would go home, and Ronaldo's like, I'm in there.
I've often thought with him, and another good example of this, I think, is someone you mentioned earlier, David Beckham. You see how well respected they are by their teammates and players who've played against them, despite their, in quotes, diva antics and their type of personality. Yeah. This very extroverted type of personality. Yet they're all universally respected.
Same as Ibrahimovic.
Yeah, so dedicated, presumably.
Yeah. I mean, the training. Carlo said to me that Ibrahimovic, when they were at PSG, was the strongest trainer, the hardest trainer, was absolutely demanding of all the other players. Why haven't you trained? I noticed you weren't training too hard today. With the other players, there's this great story in the book, and I'm sure and Ibrahimovic told it to me as well, and Carlo's told it to me, so I'm sure it's true, but it's a great story. A young player who shall remain nameless was about 17, 18, came in, and Ibrahimovic went into the dressing room at the end of training session and walked up to him and said, "Today," he said, "go home." He said, on the calendar, write on the calendar, today I trained with Ibrahimovic because I don't think you're going to be doing it again.
Well, really? Okay.
And this kid's like, shit, you know?
Yeah, okay, right.
And lo and behold, trained really hard the next day.
Yeah,
but there's, you know, there's this level of training that because they do it by example, they can demand it of others. Mm. And apparently, but Ronaldo's not that same sort of character. But just by his example, the same with Beckham, just by their example, you know, of how hard they train, how obsessed they are.
Because leadership isn't just about being loud and screaming at people and showing people outwardly how much you care. It's about a lot of it to do. Because I mean, obviously, David Beckham was England captain, and he's not really a shouter or a
Bobby Moore.
Yeah, quite exactly. So there's more than one way to skin a cat.
Yeah, absolutely.
But does management just come down to essentially having a really keenly felt intuition for what works for different individuals and when to, not only knowing that, but when to push up on it, when to not do that?
I think that's really important. I think that one of the key skill sets of great managers is to recognise when, often by accident, they've hit upon the formula.
Yeah, and sticking with it.
And not to mess with it.
Yeah.
And I think this is what Ranieri did.
Okay.
In the great Leicester. And in a sense, got found out afterwards when he had to be interventionist. Mm. You know, so when it all sort of dropped into place, what his great skill was to go, hang on a minute, this is working.
This is
working. Leave it alone. You know, very few changes. You know, the changes were always the same change. You know, Okazaki would come off, Demarai Gray would go on.
Yeah.
You know, they were all very, very samey, and this is working.
But a lot of managers would have too much of an ego.
Yeah, yeah.
To think that actually I'm not as important as I think I am here. This is working fine. Just leave it as it is.
Yeah, exactly. It's so I think that's really important. But then of course you get to the second season. Well, what do you do in terms of size? Signings and all that sort of stuff, and that's where you need all the help around you. That's where you need a whole load of backroom staff who are saying, you know, it's interesting that I don't know how involved Steve Walsh was, you know, before he left Leicester and went to Everton in the recruitment during the transfer window after the Championship.
That's right,
I don't know whether he'd already gone by then or whatever, or whether
he definitely left at some point during the tenure. Yeah.
So I don't, you know, but it's interesting that the signings that Steve Walsh oversaw, people like Mahrez and Vardy and that, were great signings, and then maybe Slimani and some of the ones who come afterwards not quite so good.
But how much of that is luck and how much of that is judgment when it comes to sort of spotting?
Well, there's a lot of research that goes into it nowadays. There's a lot of analytics go into it, but ultimately, I think, so coming back to where we started, more or less, culturally, you have to be certain. So all the numbers can say this guy is great.
Yeah.
And then you say, yeah, but apparently he's a bit of a drinker. Or apparently.
He's got to fit into the culture.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So and it's difficult. You know, we can see how few English players go abroad and do well. You know, so we just assume all these foreign players are going to come here and go, oh, that's fine, we can be great.
But the English players
don't do that well.
No.
You know, language is obviously a key thing. That's one of the things that Carlo really works hard to learn, the language. You know, I was with him when he was being courted by Bayern, and he was already learning German.
That actually tells its own story, doesn't it? You know, not to make this too current, because people are going to listen to this in a wee while, but something that I found fascinating, and we talked about it a lot on the main show we do twice a week, on the Football Ramble, is that this Mourinho Luke Shaw thing, where Jose Mourinho very publicly called out Luke Shaw. He not only sort of said to him that he's not got the dedication, he doesn't train as well. He also followed up by saying, oh, the only reason he played well in that particular half
is because
I was there, yeah. And a couple of the boys on the show were saying, yeah, this is absolutely unacceptable, this is outrageous. And I wondered whether, we did mention it on the show, but it'd be interesting to get your thoughts on it, whether Mourinho needs to benefit the doubt there, because he's clearly a good manager. He's achieved a lot in the game. He knows a lot about, he's forgotten more than we'll ever know about it. Is he not just thought, that's exactly what that player needs? He needs to be called out like that because he needs a kick up the backside to show exactly who's boss and what he needs to do. That could well be the case, couldn't it?
Oh, I think that's exactly the case. That doesn't make him right.
No, but fine, yeah.
But I think you're right. What you've said is right. I didn't hear your show, but what you've said is right, that he's doing that for a very specific reason and he believes it's going to work.
Mm.
Now, it's not something that people normally do.
Mm.
But on the other hand, he is often asked a straight question.
Yeah.
You know, how do you think Shaw played today? Yeah. Now, what's he supposed to say? Everybody sat there and watched. You know, I think what's really interesting as well, actually, forget about that. Forget about Shaw. But the other side of the coin is that he's constantly praising Pogba.
Yeah.
And he must be watching a different game to me.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
So, but he's constantly praising him because he clearly believes that this is a guy that can make the difference next season.
Yeah.
Right? So he's got to keep him on goal. He's got to get him. He's got to cajole him. Got to take his time with him. He doesn't think Shaw... He thinks Shaw can do that, but he thinks Shaw needs a different type of approach. And so he's using that type of approach. Now, the difference between... Going back to the diva whisperer, the difference is I don't think Harlow would do that with Shaw. Yeah. But I still think if we looked at the number of games Shaw's played under Mourinho and the number of games he would have played under Carlo, it'd be exactly the same.
Right,
they'd, they'd just be dealing with the personality differently, but Shaw hasn't been up to it since his injury. I mean, I used to watch him a lot at Southampton. I know you're from South Coast, and I used to watch him a lot at Southampton, and he was unbelievable.
Yeah, okay.
And he's definitely stagnated through the injury, and maybe next season may be his season.
But does Mourinho not run the risk there of not? I mean, if Luke Shaw's that personality, that's fine. But does he not run the risk of other players who are perhaps a bit more sensitive and a little more in tune to criticism in that way, thinking, well, hang on a minute, if I fall off the boiler, that could be me, and I don't fancy that very much. I mean, it's quite a high-risk strategy, isn't it?
I think so, but it's his strategy. That sort of constant volatility is his...
His thing, yeah.
He's his culture.
Didn't Zlatan say everything's a mind game with Jose?
Yeah. Exactly.
There's always an ulterior motive to whatever
he
says.
He said, whatever he's saying, don't believe it, he's saying something else.
Yeah, okay, and, you know,
but Zlatan, like, but I'm Zlatan, what do I give a shit?
Yeah, okay, right, yeah, okay. But I mean, going back to what you said earlier about the maxim about firing managers and stuff, another maxim surely would be don't criticise or discipline or call out any of your employees in public in front of other people. But yet in football, that happens all the time.
But I think it goes back to one of the points you made as well, is that there is such media focus and such media sort of awareness of everything that's going on that to a certain extent, you're not necessarily calling somebody out. If somebody says to you, what did you think of X's performance today? Mm. Yeah, my answer would obviously be, well, I subbed him after 15 minutes.
Yeah.
What do you think?
Yeah, okay,
you
know, so,
or whatever. And he's done that, by the way, hasn't he, Mourinho?
You
as well.
Don't think the players care about that?
I think the players don't like it. Mm. They don't like it, but they understand it. You know, it goes back to... I think it's really interesting, the story you told about Jamie Carragher, about saying, you know, well, I knew I was third best, but actually, I knew they were better than me. Mm. Players know... And players know when they've had a bad game. They know when they've... And that's why every now and again they'll blow up because they think it's... again, going back to my own career, I used to... Obviously, it wasn't a great career, but one of the things I prided myself on was being, you know, being brave. Mm. And I can remember once, and I was quite well behaved as a player for the manager. I wasn't high maintenance. But one of the interesting things was... One day I tried to flip a ball over a defender, try and nick it over him, and it looked as if I pulled out of the tackle.
Right, okay.
And a manager shouted something from the touchline.
Yeah.
Shouted out to me something from the touchline about pulling out. Mm. And I knew I hadn't pulled out, and I prided myself on that. I'd just stopped playing and walked over to him and had it out with him there and then, because it was like... Tell me I'm rubbish.
Yeah.
Tell me I've got a touch like a camel.
Yeah.
Do not tell me I'm a coward.
Yeah. That's your red line.
That's my thing. That was my thing.
Yeah.
And so that's why every now and again you'll see a player blow up because the manager has misinterpreted something they've done. But if they've had a rubbish game and they get pulled off, they just come off quiet.
And it's clearly a manager's responsibility to know what those red lines are of his players.
Exactly.
Right. So... Look into the future then. I mean, you've seen a lot of changes working in doing what you do in sports management and all that type of stuff. I mean, what do you think a successful manager of the future is going to need? Are they going to need to be even more media savvy, even more acutely aware of all these different things that occur? Because you've said in one of the books I read that
it's now impossible for one man to manage a football club. I mean, we go back to the days, and I know. Again, we talked about this earlier about Sir Alex Ferguson. You said, well, yeah, David Gill, and David Gill did a lot of good stuff, and that he was partly responsible for the success. But clearly, the way football's going, it's going to be even more difficult for one man to manage a job. So, manage a club. So clearly, managers need to, especially British managers, need to not be as concerned about directors of football and chief of scouts and all that sort of stuff, because it's impossible for them to do that job now.
I think what we've done is interestingly. I think it's really interesting to use the terms, you know, director of football. So I think we've boxed ourselves into a corner with the terminology. Actually, if we'd had a terminology like in US sports of general manager, that's where we're going, in my view. So we're going to have a head coach who does what we now perceive to be a manager's job. And then between him and the board, there's going to be a general manager. And the idea that, say, for the, all the analytics, for example, will only go to the manager is wrong. It will go to the head coach and the general manager. And the general manager will be saying, well, I see these statistics are saying so-and-so. What are we doing about that? How are we responding to that? So there's an accountability. When you get one guy in charge of everything, he's not accountable to anybody. But of course, he's vulnerable as well because he's supposed to be doing everything. So you can sack him easily. And so, and one of the things I say to the guys when I'm talking to them on the pro license course is, you don't ask to be in charge of everything, because if you do, you're making yourself be one of the
top
three.
More ways to fire,
be one of the top three. So if it goes wrong, it's our fault. It's not my fault. And they find it really difficult. They're like, nah.
Is that because of their ego? They want to be.
I think it's more to do. It's more to do with tradition. They think that's what they're supposed to want. They think it's somehow, less macho, if you like, if they're passing that responsibility off. But ultimately, you need to come back and say, what's best for the team. Because whether you like it or not, you look at a football club as a business. The core business is what goes on the pitch. Because if you're winning, you're selling more shirts, you're selling more tickets, you're selling more sponsorship, you're selling more TV. So it's actually the business of what goes on the pitch is vital to the club. And so that guy in charge, the head coach, is a very important role, and you shouldn't diminish that. But it's about, it's almost, I suppose, if I were trying to draw an analogy, it would be the COO. You know, he's a chief operations officer, because that's the operations of the club. Then you've got the commercial stuff all going. You don't want him getting involved in that. You know, you want him concentrating on that. And so what you need to be able to do, and what a lot of the managers in the continent do, and it's unusual in this country, they're always surprised, continental managers, that they get. You know, when Klopp came to Liverpool, for example, and they asked him about the committee for recruitment, he went, why not? That's what we always do. As if I'm going to make those decisions, if I'm going to make an £80 million decision on my own. So you need that. And once you accept that it's not demeaning you in any way, or it's not emasculating you in any way, you're still the guy, then I think it'll come on. And this general manager role will gradually emerge, because it does away with the... It doesn't have football in the title. You know, so sporting director, football director, director of football, you know, well, hang on, I thought I was the football guy. Yeah, you are the football guy. But you need to be accountable to somebody, and you don't want to be accountable to the board. And I'm talking at top level now. Obviously, if you're going back to long-serving managers, if you're Paul Tisdale at Exeter,
you do everything.
You do everything. You do everything.
Which means if he does then make the jump up to a higher level, he might find it difficult to adjust. He's going to be very conscious that it's going to be a different role.
Absolutely. I think Paul will. I mean, I know Paul reasonably well, and I know that he's been offered lots and lots of jobs that he's never quite taken. Probably, and I don't know this, so if he ever listened to this, I'm sure he can phone me and tell me, but probably because he couldn't have the level of control that he wanted. Actually, an interesting story, when I was doing the Carlo book, I interviewed Carl, Roberto Martinez. And what was interesting, I said, have you ever thought of going back to Spain, you know, coaching? He was still at Everton at the time. And he said, no, he said, I wouldn't want to go. I like it in England, because England's the only place you can be the manager and do everything. That's what I want to do.
So it suits him, basically.
That's what I want to do. Yeah. And I said, and this is true. I said, you know, it's going to get you the sack sooner rather than later. And he said, I know, but that's what I want to do.
That FA Cup win's his.
Yeah, exactly.
He thinks that's all his.
Exactly. So, exactly right. So Again, goes back to culture, horses for courses.
Well, if you're comfortable with the, with taking responsibility and accepting the fact that you've been fired and you can reconcile yourself with that, presumably you could enjoy that FA Cup win is all yours
as well.
Well,
he's manager of Belgium now. He seems well happy.
I bet he is, So just finally to finish up then, what does the successful manager of the future at the top level of football look like? What have they got to be good at that perhaps they weren't necessarily needing to be good at in the past?
They are, notwithstanding what we've just said about Roberto, I think they need to be good at recognising the function that they play. I think when you look at all organisations, I tend to be a bit of a functionalist, and I look at organisations and say, what functions need to be performed in order for this organisation to work properly? And in football, there's three functions. There's leadership, there's management, and there's coaching. And the leadership might be the chairman, the management might be the general manager, and the coaching might be the head coach. Now, if those three are all working well, then that guy needs to understand what his function is as a head coach or as an assistant coach or as a goalkeeping coach. What precisely is your function? And the biggest difference, I think, of the manager of the future is understanding where he fits into the pattern. At the moment, they think, I've just got to keep the chairman happy.
Yeah, okay.
You know, they don't understand the whole business. And again, I think that's true even down in the second division, even in the conference, the National League now, that you have big structures now. Now, they're only small businesses. You know, we're talking about £2-3 million businesses at lower levels. But if you can understand that structure so that, you know, when the Cowley brothers of Lincoln suddenly got offered, I don't know, Notts Forest tomorrow or something, they need to know what the structure is going to be and they need to be able to accept their role in that structure. And I think that's a big jump for a lot of people who've grown up with the gaffer or the boss and, you know, and the old idea of, you know, I don't even remember, I think it was Brian Clough or, you know, the big book of director's knowledge.
Yeah,
blank. Open up and it's blank. That's gone. By the way, they might be right.
Yeah.
But they're the guys who are employing you.
Yeah. Professor Chris Brady, thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome.
This was a Radio Stakhanov production.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper and tons more,
and join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.